We come now in the lectionary to, at least in the terms of the epistle readings, to Paul's epistle to the Corinthians, his first epistle. He wrote a number of letters to the Corinthians. The Corinthian church was one that had a fair number of problems, and these problems continued even afterwards. One of the most interesting references that I ran across to the to Paul's letters to the Corinthians is actually in the Epistle of Clement, who was at that time Bishop of Rome, written about AD 94, so about a generation later, in which he is writing to the Corinthians again, because once again they've kind of messed up. And he encourages them to read the letters that they have from the blessed Apostle Paul. So they'd kept the letters around, which is why they're in our New Testament, and they were being exhorted again to reread those letters that Paul sent them all the way back then. So Paul came to Corinth immediately after Athens and his famous speech in Athens on the at the Areopagus. His reception in Athens wasn't particularly great. He was invited to speak on Mars Hill, the Areopagus, or however you pronounce it. And he got a chance to give one of my favorite sermons of all time to the Athenians. But as he gets to, in which he quotes their own poets to them, and he says to them, you know, this unknown God whom you worship, because I see that you're very religious, I'm going to declare him to you. But when he gets to the resurrection, which was, interestingly, was one of the reasons that they had invited him to speak in the first place, is he's talking about this guy named Jesus and this other thing called the resurrection. Not sure whether it's a god or what. When he gets to the resurrection from the dead, they all basically just laugh him out of court, because the Greeks didn't think that a bodily resurrection from the dead was something to be desired. The body was something to be dismissed. And so Paul, you know, there's a few people who join him in Athens, but he basically packs up and goes off to the next major city in Achaia, which is Corinth. Corinth was of course a very important city in the ancient world, as it was located right there on the little isthmus that joins the little kind of hand bit of Greece that's sticking down to the rest of the mainland. And so it was a great city of commerce, an important port. And as Paul gets there, he finds a lot more success there than in Athens. This is where he meets Priscilla and Aquila, who are tent makers like himself, like literal makers of tents, just like himself. He hangs out with them for a bit. Timothy and Silas join him, and the response in Corinth is so good that it's that God actually speaks to Paul and says, "Look, you should stay here for a while. I've got a lot of people here." So he stays there for a year and a half, which is, I think, maybe the second longest time that he stays in one place in his missionary journey, the longest being in Ephesus. And then he takes Priscilla and Aquila with him, goes back to Ephesus, which again is his other major center of missionary work, and then in Ephesus, Aquila and Priscilla meet Apollos. And Apollos is a Jew who knows something of the way. Priscilla and Aquila take him aside and instruct him more perfectly in the way. And Apollos feels that he's called by God to go into the regions of Achaia and encourage the brethren there. So he goes down to all of the various churches down there, including Corinth. So, sometime after that, or possibly even while Apollos is still there, Paul gets word, as we just heard in the bit of the epistle that we heard read today, that there's divisions in the church. Oh, one other interesting bit about the epistle to the Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians is it's the earliest of all of the Christian writings that we have in the New Testament. If I'm not correct, it's written about AD 55. So here we have the very first written record of what the early Christians were experiencing. And what is it about? It's about them not getting along. He says, I've heard from members of the household of Chloe, so rumors have reached me from members of Chloe's household, that there are divisions among you where some of you say, I'm of Paul, others say, I'm of Apollos, others say, I'm of Cephas, and yet others say, I'm of Christ. And he says, really? Essentially. He says, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were any of you baptized in the name of Paul? Given this division, I thank God that I didn't even baptize any of you. Well, except for Gaius and Crispus. And some members of the household of Stephanus. But aside from that, I don't remember baptizing any of you. You kind of get a sense that Paul's maybe a little bit frustrated here. Here the Corinthians are, and I know especially nowadays when we look around at various other Christian groups and we see 30,000 different groups that can't get along with one another, but this is nothing new. This is right back at the very beginning. Already Paul is having to tell them, look. It's not about me. It's not about Peter, Cephas. It's not about Apollos. You weren't baptized in my name. It's about Christ. Interesting side note here. It's interesting that Paul didn't baptize very many people. The only thing I can think of here, I have to admit, I haven't done my homework here, but the only thing I can think of here is there seems to be a pattern in terms of how Jesus and his disciples and Paul and his worked. Basically, as soon as they could hand something off to others to do for them, they did. And you see this even in the gospel reading we just heard today, where Jesus takes the bread and the fish and he breaks it and he gives it to his disciples. And his disciples then distribute it to the people. They always seem to be doing that because the work of the church, the work of Christ, is given to us. So Paul's able to say, look, I didn't really even baptize any of you except, Gaius and Crispus and a few members of the household of Stephanus, or the whole household of Stephanus. For Christ, he says, does not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. Not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of no effect. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. He goes on, Jews request a sign. Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews, a stumbling block, and to the Greeks, foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So Paul didn't come to save people by baptizing them. He didn't come to save people by anything that he did himself. He wasn't crucified for them. He came to talk to them. And not even to talk to them with great eloquence. He didn't use lots of fancy language and powerful rhetoric. He came and he spoke simply to them. He spoke simply to them about something that was, to anybody else, kind of ridiculous. And the Jews, for example, he says, are looking for a sign. They want a sign, any kind of sign, just something, some kind of miraculous thing that manifests the power of God. And the Greeks are seeking after wisdom. I mean, that's why they had invited him to speak at the Areopagus. And they're expecting some kind of deep philosophy, not some message about some guy who rose from the dead. Like, that's going to be helpful. And so, to Jews, this was a stumbling block. This isn't a sign that manifests the power of God. This is a guy who's been crucified by our enemies, the Romans. This isn't a great deep philosophy that the Greeks can kind of sink their teeth into. It's like, this is just some guy who, you know, you're claiming that he rose from the dead and is going to be our judge. What's the point of that? Resurrection of the dead? We're trying to escape the body, not actually have another body. So to the Greeks, it's a stumbling block. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block because they're looking for the power of God being manifested. For the Greeks, this is foolishness. It's just stupid. But, he says, to us who are being saved, this is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because God's weakness is stronger than anything that we have. God's foolishness is wiser than anything that we have as human beings. Because God, in his wisdom, chose the most ridiculous, weakest manifestation of himself to save us, the cross. God stuck on the cross, as my kids would say. And this is the manifestation of the power of God, of the glory of God, and it is the way by which he saves us. If you think about what we expect of God, what we expect of God is something impressive. Even the great atheist science fiction writer Douglas Adams has God's last message to the universe written in letters 30 feet high on this great mountain. Something impressive. Since he's an atheist and a humorist, it's a silly message. But that's kind of what we expect. Something big. You know, God writing in letters of fire on the wall or something like that. Or we expect salvation in terms that we would look for it. And if we think about it, we still think this way. We're not that different. Just as we still struggle with the tendency to divide over various things from one another, we also struggle with the tendency to look for God's hand in something great, in something powerful, in something miraculous, in something... How often do we look for his handiwork in something lowly, in something ugly, in something where we ourselves have failed in a dramatic way? We don't generally look at that and say, oh, well, God missed me at work in that for my salvation. And yet that's exactly how God chose to reveal himself, in weakness, in humility. That's where he shows us his love. And so for us, this foolishness, this weakness, as we embrace it, as we come to understand it, as we come to see God working in this manner, this cross becomes for us our salvation. This way of the cross. Paul goes on, and I just want to get us to the point where he kind of resolves the dispute, or we'll do a little bit more of this next week, but because he picks up with this as well, in the reading next week. But he goes on to talk to the Corinthians and say, look, I do speak a word of wisdom among the mature. But I deliberately came in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. Well, we speak wisdom among those who are mature. You have to be able to realize that there's stuff that you're not going to get. I mean, the rulers of this age didn't understand. If they had known beforehand, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is within him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. This, says Paul, is why you get it. This is why you understood it, and nobody around you understood it. Because who knows the innermost secrets of the heart? What knows your secrets other than your Spirit? What knows the innermost secrets of God's heart except the Spirit of God? The very Spirit that came upon you when you were baptized. So this is why you get it. Because you have the Spirit of God, as he says a little later, we have the mind of Christ. We have, in receiving the Spirit of God, in being in harmony with God and his Spirit, in walking in this way, we actually have insight into the deepest, innermost secrets of the heart of God himself. We understand that he is at work in all things. We understand that he loves, and that the ultimate manifestation of his love comes precisely in moments of weakness, in moments when we need his strength, and when we are ourselves failing. This is when God is working to save us. But he says, I, brethren, could not speak to you as spiritual people. So he's just talked about how you need to have the Spirit of God to understand, and this is why you did understand and you got it. But he says, I can't speak to you as spiritual people right now because you're not acting like it. This division that's there among you, it's not from God. It's not from his Spirit. It's from the flesh. From living in a way that puts the desires of the flesh above your Spirit, which is now made to be in harmony with God. So even if we have received it, it's possible for us to not understand anymore because we're living after the flesh. This is why sin is a bad thing. It draws us away from God. It obscures our vision. It prevents us from understanding the deep things of God. And so Paul says to the Corinthians, look, I really wanted to give you some meat, but I had to just feed you with milk, with baby food, because you're not ready for it. It's like, who is Paul? Who is Paul? Who is Apollos? You're arguing over who's a follower of Paul and who's a follower of Apollos. Who are these people? They're just servants. Just laborers. So yeah, of course, I planted. Paul was the first one there, so he planted the seed. And Apollos watered the seed. But who was it who gave it life? Who was it who made the seed grow? It was neither Paul nor Apollos. It was God who gives the increase. So he says, neither Paul nor Apollos are anything, really. It's all God, all God's work. So Paul's very concerned for the Corinthians, and by extension for us, that we live in unity with one another, that we be united and speak the same thing, as he says, that we are united by a common understanding, a common belief, that what we have received, that we continue in that, because that message that we have received about the cross, that's our salvation. And we need to continue in that in order not to fall back into a way of life that is fleshly, that is dominated by the flesh. But rather that we should be focused on not only the health of our spirit, but the health of our spirit as it is in harmony, in communion with God's spirit, so that we can understand what it is to live out this way of the cross, so that we can understand how it is that God is working in all things, even the things that seem like failures and horrible, messed up tragedies. He's working precisely in that for our salvation. And he encourages them to see himself, Apollos, all of the people through whom the message has come to them, as merely servants. And by extension, themselves as merely servants. They're all working for the same cause. They're all working in the same field. They are one in the work. They need to be one in the work, because the ultimate work is done not by them. It's not that their work is not important, but the ultimate work, the success of that work, is dependent upon the work of God himself. Because as God takes what we have offered in humility, in love, in brokenness, in tragedy, he is able, if it is offered in this spirit of peace, in his spirit, he is able to take that and to use it for the blessing of the work as a whole, for the growth of the harvest as a whole. So then he makes all of our labor one great work, his work, that he might draw us all to unity with one another in Christ, that he might raise us up with Christ, and that he might glorify us in the same way that he glorified his Son, manifesting his glory, his power, even in the midst of our suffering, that we might be truly one, truly his, truly to his glory, the glory of the Father and of the Son, the Holy Spirit, now and ever and unto ages of ages.